inventors and their inventions. Welcome to Radio Cade, a podcast from the Cade Museum for Creativity and Invention in Gainesville, Florida. The museum is named after James Robert Cade, who invented Gatorade in 1965. My name is Richard Miles. We'll introduce you to inventors and the things that motivate them. We'll learn about their personal stories, how their inventions work, and how their ideas get from the laboratory to the marketplace.
Startup culture is a big part of what fuels our economy and our country. Is there a startup recipe for success and a way to pick winners and losers? I'm Richard Miles, your host. Today, my guest is Russ Donda, entrepreneur in residence at the Great Lakes Innovation and Development Enterprise, also a lecturer at Case Western University, a founder of Emergent Growth Fund in Florida, also a medical device expert, and a participant as an investor or advisor in over 300 startup companies. Welcome to Radio Cade, Russ.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Russ, let's get to the most important question first. Is Silicon Valley the best show ever made?
You know, dollars beget dollars, right? And so they have pumped out a lot of stuff and they've made a lot of people very wealthy. I think my bottom line on that, speaking maybe more philanthropically, is did all that money ultimately go to good use? I hope so.
Yeah, that's an open question. Russ, let's start by broadly defining what you and I mean by startups, just so we're on the same page. And I think for our listeners, so they get an idea. So I'll give you my definition, then you tell me how far off I am. In my view, startups is not interchangeable with small business. And that's taking nothing away from small business, because obviously it fuels a giant chunk of our economy. It's hard to do. But in my mind, a startup, it's a small company based on a new idea, and preferably a new idea that can scale. Is that what you would define startup as?
You and I are on the same page, and I would say that that is the beginning of a definition. So let me add a couple more things to it. It is the beginning of an idea, and if the startup is going to be successful, at least in the field in which I work, that idea should be novel. Secondly, it takes generally a serious plan and then working that plan. And working that plan includes the other important component of startups, and that is funding, bringing money in to move that startup along. So yeah, I'm with you, and I just added those extra things as I think about it.
Good definition. I'm perfectly willing to work with that. But let's talk first about the type of people who do this. Saying on a general level, most people don't, in fact, quit their perfectly good corporate jobs to live in their parents' basement and race through other people's money. That's not a natural inclination. But you've seen probably hundreds of different founders, and I'm willing to bet that they share some similar traits in terms of personality and character. And again, I know there are exceptions, but if you had to generalize and boil it down to, say, three or five characteristics, what do you see personally in that founder figure? And I would include in this both successful and unsuccessful founders. Are there a common set of personality characteristics, traits that you see?
I think that there has to be this inherent drive to solve problems or to solve a particular problem and to believe that, and I'm going to say, quote, may, unquote, have the solution. That drive to say, I've got a problem and I think I've got a solution, which, by the way, is very different than being sure that you have a solution, because I've seen too many folks who drink their own Kool-Aid and just refuse to quit when they should quit or to at least pivot. So you have that, and you have to be willing to be a risk taker, because in the end, when you're doing this kind of endeavor, when you're an entrepreneur in a startup, when it comes to being compensated, you have to look in the mirror. So you have to realize that this is all about what you are going to accomplish, but it's never a one-person thing. And that's a huge learning point for many early founders, especially young folks. It's a team effort. Everything requires a team effort. I've never seen anything happen in terms of having to develop an innovation without having that kind of team effort. I mean, if we're looking at attributes, I can tell you that I have seen failure after failure, not because the idea that was being promulgated was deficient, but because of an inability to adequately convey, to communicate the idea. I see that mistake happen all the time when I see it in presentations, routinely.
One thing that we have noticed in running the Cade Prize and also the Cade Museum as we interact with inventors is like a curiosity for problem solving. And almost to the person, we've never seen somebody that starts out, at least, I want to get rich. Now, that may come later as the product grows and develops, but very few people, I think, set out to do this sort of as like, this is the way I'm going to even make a living. It's that they're bursting with usually ideas and problem solving, and they've just got to get it out into the world, no matter what the field is. And later on, if they do achieve commercial success, obviously money may come into it a big way. I think you said it already, but if you don't have somebody that just naturally is always thinking about how do I make A and B go together better, or think I've got a better way to do whatever, if that's not a core part of their personality, they're probably not, I'm guessing, going to be a startup founder. Or have you found something different?
It is rare to meet with a founder and have their focus be on making money from the business. It's rare to experience that. At the same time, I think we have to realize that part of what drives these innovations forward is knowing that there's that potential on the other end. When I work with my startups, the entire focus is always on driving toward commercialization. It's not about selling the company from the start. It's about driving toward commercialization. And when the time is right, and we can talk about an acquisition or becoming publicly traded, that sort of thing. So yeah, in general, I agree with you.
When you do talk about finances or that commercialization path, I'm curious, do you think most of those inventors, even if they're super passionate about an idea, do they have a realistic idea of the scale of success that's possible for them? Or do they all believe they're going to be the next Steve Jobs and Bill Gates? Or are their expectations a little bit more realistic in terms of what commercialization success could mean for them?
The folks I work with are all folks that are less seasoned, right? So it's not like I'm sitting in meetings, although I am on a board with a seasoned group, but it's not like I sit in these meetings with folks that have a lot of experience. So because of their inexperience, they're not able to really think about the scale and what a liquidity event may look like. They have to be taught that. They have to be taught that. And there's a process that we look at in that sort of thing.
Describe for the listeners what your typical day or week is like. You're director of an incubator. I presume a lot of people come in are doing advanced research. They're not just starting out in terms of their idea. They've probably been thinking about it, developing for a while. What sort of things do they need or can the incubator give them that they don't have?
So I'm an entrepreneur in residence for Glide in the Innovation Fund, and we do have an incubator there, although I'm not director of the incubator. So I serve as the entrepreneur in residence. So I'm actually the boots on the ground in working with these folks. And the question is, what is a typical day and week? It is typically filled with meetings where I'm either meeting new founders that are seeking funds from the Innovation Foundation, for example. We have A grants, 25 to 50,000, and then B's up to 125,000. And that's four times a year. So I'm meeting with startups that are always saying they want to apply. So I engage them and I go through the process of how I can help them. I have a particular slide order that I think is appropriate to use for investors. And so there's that process. Now, whether or not I meet again with those folks, it's up to them. If I think they've got something really hot, then I will certainly pursue them and say, listen, we need to meet again. Then the other meetings are meetings for startups that I've continued to work with on an ongoing basis, helping them through the various stages of their commercialization, either as just an advisor or as an active board member.
Why don't we talk about that a little bit more in detail? Because my limited experience of doing this is that the problem isn't so much weeding out bad ideas, because you tend to get very few truly bad or completely unworkable ideas on the face of it. It's more that, okay, they all look interesting and there's usually something to back it up. There might be a prototype, there might be some promising work in the lab. But the holy grail, I guess, for investors or for VC firms is that at that stage, is there a rule of thumb in terms of initial metrics, initial vetting, that you take a look at a founder or a proposal and think like, okay, four out of five of these look really good or not, that would separate them from the pack in terms of how do you decide, like you said, some of them you spend more time with than others, or you might not even do a second meeting. What are the things that you decide, okay, this is definitely worth a second or a third meeting when you see them?
So it's a good question, and I think I've got a pretty good answer for it. So I started off with the consulting business back before there was Regeneration Technologies, and my consulting business was called Strategies 2000, and I was working with startups and scientists, other inventors back then, and then met Jamie Grooms, and ultimately ended Strategies 2000 and became a co-founder of Regeneration Technologies. So I did all that, and then I was part of a handful of startups. And then probably I really took a deep dive into being an entrepreneur in residence for the last 10 or 11 years. And for all of this background experience, I put together what I think are the five fundamentals, the five keys that every startup has to address in order to work towards success. Number one is, and this, you would be shocked at how many startups blow it on this first one. Tell me about your IP. Tell me about your prior art search. And you would be shocked at how many people have not done a prior art search, how many people end up filing superfluous patent applications. And listen, I'm not going to take anything away from patent attorneys, but it's not the patent attorney's job to determine if there's a business based on these claims or a product that can be sold. So there's a real problem with IP. So you've got to understand if you're infringing others. I've had so many people that are already infringing with a startup idea. So you've got to understand if you're infringing. You've got to understand if what you have is patentable. Number two is, how does that parlay into a competitive advantage? And I say that because just as many people don't understand how claims give you the protection to make a product, is that product that you're protected on actually going to give you a competitive advantage in the marketplace? So we don't have time for examples there, but that's the second thing. Now, what we're seeing in the United States is just a mushrooming of IT-based app kind of startups. So many of those, there's nothing there that you can actually get a patent on, but yet we still see investors putting money into those things. So you still have to show that you've got some kind of competitive advantage. All right, that's two. Number three is, how large is the market in which you're playing? If this is going to be a VC play, so if you're going to have to raise more than $10 million and it's going to be a VC play, the VCs want to see a market of at least $500 million a year. If you're dealing with private angels, maybe you could get by with a couple hundred million a year if you really have a strong competitive advantage. So that's three, the size of the market. It's got to be a good size market. Number four is, and this is really crucial, and this is one of the most time-consuming parts for the startups to undertake, and that is, what is your task and your timeline to get this innovation commercialized? What are the tasks you need to accomplish? What are the milestones? How long is it going to take? And how much money is it going to take to get to each of those milestones? So in one slide, I have a snapshot of where the business has been, what it's got to do, where it's going, and how much money it takes. That's the fourth key. The fifth key applies to devices, not to software, but it's the unit manufacturing cost. Can you make this at a price which gives you high gross margins, and yet you can sell it, be competitive in the market? So those are the five keys that I look at all the time. And I got to tell you, it usually stops right in the first or second one. And then they have homework to do.
Those sound very familiar from the judging process that we've used in the prize. And what strikes me too is that a lot of the people with those great ideas, for instance, an engineering professor or a biology professor, this is a totally different world for them. They're not used to thinking in terms of unit production costs. They're not thinking in terms of how big is the market, because their world is, I do research, I publish, I talk about what I've published at conferences, and then I get a grant, I do some more research. That's their world. So what for you is fairly common sense, I imagine for some of your clients, as you said, they come in and this is like they haven't even thought about it, or they're not even aware that someone else may be doing this work. I saw you wrote someplace that one of the best early indicators is how open they are to advice, right? Because if they understand this about themselves, they understand they've got these shortcomings in terms of their knowledge base, and they go find somebody, whether it's an advisor or a board member, then maybe they can get through that initial desert, so to speak. How often is the case that you find very talented, brilliant people come in and say, I can do this all by myself?
Probably more than I like to see. And I think I'm generally able to convince the majority of them that this is going to have to be a team effort, that they're going to have to loosen their clenched fist and take that equity and share that. And that there's really going to be nothing more valuable than building that team and everybody pulling together. So I see it. I think by and large, I'm able to talk people out of it, but there are some people that you cannot change their minds.
What is it that they're afraid of, or are they afraid of something, or are they just overconfident in their own ability to figure this out? One thing that we've encountered is often you're dealing with people who have always been the smartest person in the room. They're a brilliant physicist, they're a brilliant engineer, they've always been the top of their class. and they underestimate just how complicated or rather unpredictable that path to market can be. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, I do find that, but generally, I'm able to kind of shed light on some of the daunting tasks that lie ahead. I mean, even just explaining those five keys, right? I mean, because when you do that task and timeline, as an example, you really need engineers with you, right? Because they're the ones who really understand some of the activities that need to be undertaken to build something, to move something along. But I think that generally we're able to convey this by and large to folks that this is daunting and that we're going to need a team, even if they're just contractors for now, we're going to need that and then build into that. So I probably don't work with people that won't open up to that, right?
It sounds like you have a very compelling tough love speech, right? For an initial inventor who decides, okay, maybe I do need some help here.
I'm pretty blunt. I've been accused of that many times. And what I tell them is, I'm telling you though, my opinion, it's just my opinion, but I'm going to tell you what I think. So you're not going to hear from someone else that I was thinking something else about you. When you hear me, that's really me.
You get the original version. Let's fast forward just a little bit in the timeline. Let's say somebody comes in a company, they've done all these five steps. Let's say they're a year, 18 months into it, and then they struggle. And this happens a lot, right? Where the startup makes an initially promising start, and then they hit a rough patch. Have you been able to isolate, or could you isolate maybe the top three reasons why a startup that has a successful launch fails, say, 2 or 3 years into their venture?
Are you talking failure while they're still in the development stage?
Pre-market, right? They're not actually selling product yet, but let's say they just fall way short of raising the capital they needed, and then the founders part ways or just give up.
Yeah, I think there are two major issues there that complicate that. One is not being able to get the money that you need. That's probably the biggest single thing. And the second thing is not having the right people. So when you have both of those, you are golden, generally speaking. And to me, it is really quite amazing to see how companies propel themselves when they bring in the right folks. And I will tell you that those right folks include not mentors and trusted advisors, but it includes a trusted board that's seasoned with startups and that can really offer you strategic input. In my opinion, that's one of the earlier things that every startup should do, form that board.
You know, I spent most of my career in government, Russ. And so one of the things that surprised me when I started interacting with people in the startup world was the speed at which people come in and go out of these small micro companies. And part of it was like the line from The Godfather, it's not personal, it's business, right? If you have somebody who's either not right or underperforming, you cannot afford to keep them one more day or one more week than is necessary. Where in government, that person can stay for 20 years. But in a startup culture, sometimes it's just not a fit for that particular culture. And they know it, you know it, and they got to go. And that happens within days or weeks, as I said, rather than years usually.
Yeah. And that also leads to a sidebar. And that is the importance of when you're laying out your cap table and your incentives to be sure that things are based on a vesting structure so that someone doesn't get all this ownership and then they're gone, but to vest their ownership over a period of time or based on milestones.
Right. No, that's a very good point. Let's switch now and talk to the context or I guess the environment in which startups are created and fostered and thrive. Obviously, nothing happens in a vacuum. There are other players sort of background structure. What are some of the things in your view that government or at least maybe even the broader business community can do? Let's start maybe with the local or state level. Let's leave the federal level out of it for the moment. What are sort of things that a city or a state would do if they wanted to see or encourage the development of startup companies?
That's really a deep subject. It's a great subject to really spend some time talking about. I'm going to get real fundamental here. You generally have people that are quite open to ideas and are able to think creatively. And you also have people that are not so open and tend to do things as they've always been done. In order to have a startup culture, to have a region that is rich in startups, you really need to have a preponderance of people that are not closed down and just want to keep doing things the way they've always been done. But you want people who are going to be open-minded and get excited about solving problems. So you need that kind of people. And, you know, I don't want to use the term young people, but we have all of these college age, college grads up their 30s, a lot of folks like this starting businesses. So they need to be in a culture that then supports that openness it is important to have institutions of higher learning or research labs that have a good process in place for releasing innovation into the community for development. Where I am, we have, and I'm not going to name it, but we have a big federal lab. And that federal lab does not have a conflict of interest policy so that its scientists can create startups. It's really sad. Now, maybe that's unusual for a federal lab. I don't know. But all of our universities here have policies and they put out any number of companies. But it's one thing to have a faculty member with an idea. It's another thing to be able to match that up with someone who wants to then turn that into a business. Those are the people that you want to be attracting. They're really younger folks. Obviously, you can attract a certain amount of seasoned people, and that's a good thing, too. So you got to have policies in place that younger folks are happy with. If you're putting things in place that turn off that crowd, you're going to stifle your growth, I think.
Excellent point. I think a lot of people are under the mission pressure. Probably a lot of city governments is like, well, all we have to do is say, give a tax incentive or free land or something like that, and we'll attract these innovative companies or startups. But you really put your finger on it. It's an ecosystem, I think, of one, creative people, but then also you have to have probably more people like you, Russ, and that they've got the experience to mentor or give advice to those creative people to channel their energies in a productive direction. And then ultimately, you've got to have capital, right? So you've got to have enough people willing to invest, either VCs or private equity or other angel investors, so that once you do have an idea, it's off and running, they can actually start to grow. And some of the experience that we've seen is that you might have two or three of those things. So you might have creative people and you've got mentoring, but then you run out of money or the companies run out of money and they're the ones that move to Silicon Valley or they're the ones that move to somewhere else where they can get that constellation. And that's where I think maybe a lot of cities might lose out. But of course, they've got to have the first two to begin with, right, before they even get to the money part.
One of the important parts about the money is, for example, the Innovation Fund and the CAPE funding is that early money that allows you to validate what you're doing such that you reduce the risk for the next round of investors, I think is really key to engendering that kind of startup culture. We've got it here. This is in Cleveland in the Northeast Ohio area. We have the Innovation Fund. And it has, I don't know the count now, but hundreds of startups it's spun out that have gone on to raise hundreds of millions of dollars. You've got to have that early funding. So the service that you are providing through the CADE Fund, to my way of thinking, is really crucial as a first step in that process. But then it does take a whole ecosystem.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that we really are pleased about with the CADE Prize or things like the CADE Prize is we recognize that sometimes those early days, they don't need much, but they do need something. They need to hire somebody or they need to make a prototype or they need to file for a patent. And if they don't have even a little bit of money, they're going to languish or go very, very slowly. Russ, one more thing. We always like to wrap up these interviews. We're talking about the person themselves. So let's talk about a little bit, Russ Donda. Tell us, what were you like as a kid? Were you the first guy on your street with a lemonade stand or a bunch of lemonade stands? Did you own a fleet of lawnmowers in your neighborhood? Were there early indications early in your life that you would get into the entrepreneur arena?
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time, but now reflecting on it, I was quite an arguer. If you told me something and I didn't agree with it, you would hear from me on it. In fact, I got in trouble in school. They had to have parent-teacher conferences say he's arguing too much with the teacher. And I remember, you're going to laugh at this one. I shouldn't even tell this, but I remember I was 6 months old and I remember being in the crib and I remember looking at the side rail and I remember thinking, why is this holding me in here? And I climbed out and down the stairs. But I was fortunate to grow up in a relatively rural area outside of Cleveland. As soon as you're a half hour out of Cleveland, you're in the countryside. And so I've always been exposed to nature. And so I was self-taught, did a considerable amount of reading in the sciences with nature. And so I actually was on a track for that in my undergrad and switched to business for reasons I won't get into, but switched to business. And now in my life, I get to work with that science and I get to work with such bright people. And then I bring in the business side of it. So it's almost as if a lot of what I did as a youngster has come full circle, and I feel pretty blessed to be in this position.
Did any of this run in the family? Did either of your parents, were they business owners or in the business arena?
No, they were not, but they were always, they questioned a lot. I wouldn't call them recalcitrant, but this city policy, this government policy, this opinion, they questioned a lot. My father was probably like people that you know or have known. When I would work with my father alongside him on a car or a tractor or whatever, and there was a problem, he would always say, there's a way to figure this out. And he would use divergent reasoning a lot of times. And you could tell it was divergent reasoning when you looked at the fix. But he fixed it. And I learned early on that there's always a solution. There's always a way to do something. So that's kind of my background.
That's a great story. I remember reading a book, great book called Shop Class is Soulcraft. It probably came out at least 10 years ago. A guy named Matthew Crawford. One of the things he talks about was one of the downsides of devices getting more sophisticated or less maintenance required. Take an automobile, for instance, right? Whereas before, the average person would have to know how to get under the hood and do basic things. Change the oil,
set the, point.
The fan belt, water, yep. Spark plugs, whatever. Everyone kind of knew that. Some knew it better than others. And now you lift up the hood of your car and you can't touch any of that stuff.
I know. I don't like that.
So even if you wanted to be a problem solver in an everyday way, in that fashion, the nature of sort of modern products, modern devices, you can't open them. You literally cannot open them, like your iPhone, right? I guess now we'll be able to fix our own iPhones eventually, right? I just read somewhere. But otherwise, you can't do your own tinkering. And that part of his argument was saying this inability to have the chance to problem solve makes us all less problem solvers, right? Because we're just used to someone else figuring out whatever it is. Well, I thought it was an interesting thesis.
That's true. That's actually scary because as far as I can see, we need more problem solving, more divergent reasoning now than we've ever needed. We are facing not just problems, we're facing predicaments.
Yeah. And what I like about what you do, Russ, and this is where I show my bias because I'm leaning in this direction as well, is you are a problem solver for systems. Because really, what is a startup but a system? It's a system of relationships between the inventor and the people who come in and help develop the idea and then the market, right? That those are all complex systems that you can't nail down any one variable and say, this is the variable. It's 100 variables and they're always changing. And I think that is what kind of the beauty, I think, or the strength of the American economies. We've got a lot of people who are pretty good at that.
Very good.
Russ, thank you so much for coming on RadioCade. Wish you the best of luck with the companies that you're working with, that you're either leading or advising. You're doing great work.
Thank you, Richard. It was fun. Thank you so much.
RadioCade is produced by the Cade Museum for Creativity and Invention, located in Gainesville, Florida. Richard Miles is the podcast host, and Ellie Tom coordinates inventor interviews. Podcasts are recorded at Hardwood Soundstage and edited and mixed by Bob McPeak. The RadioCade theme song was produced and performed by Tracy Collins and features violinist Jacob Lawson.